See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 344. Thursday, August 15th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, See Rome Vault subscribers, KMO here. And what I have for you is a conversation with my friend Rob. Now, I took down all of my good equipment to the place where we recorded. I had Sennheiser stick mics on stands, and they were both plugged in via XLR cable to my Tascam field recorder, which for reasons that I just cannot explain, would not power up. Tried it with a plug-in power source from several different outlets, tried it with batteries, got fresh batteries, it just would not power up, so I ended up using my backup recorder, which it's a Zoom H1, and, you know, it's a pretty handy little thing. That's what it's called. It's called the H1 Handy Recorder. But it's not my first choice, and the sound quality, it's not what I'd like it to be. The worst part about it is that, Rob had some notes in front of him, and every time he touched the table, it sounds like a boom, and every time he moved a piece of paper, well, it sounds like like a tornado or something. I mean, it is what it is. The content, I think, is worth, whatever mental effort it takes to tune out the distractions. So before I get started, this conversation, like the last See Rome Vault conversation, takes as its starting point John Michael Greer's recent essay on his blog, Ecosophia. The essay is called The Next Twilight of Environmentalism, and it is no longer at the top of the page, but right now, as I record these words, it is the second from the top item. And in it, he claims that there is a viewpoint primarily being articulated on the fringes of the leftist environmentalist blogosphere right now, but which he thinks is going to move into mainstream punditry in the near future, and that is the idea that any talk of ecological limits is racist at its core. And I posted a comment asking for an example of such a blog, and somebody sent me to the following. It's an interview on basepublication.org. It's called On Climate, Borders, Survival, Care, Struggle, with slashes between each of those instead of commas. The interviewer is asking questions of two folks who go by the collective title of Out of the Woods. And the first question is this. The Out of the Woods Collective has been publishing vital analysis investigating capitalism and its relationship to climate change on LibCom for over 3 years, all of which can be read at libcom.org/out-of-the-woods. We sat with them for a conversation that we hope will allow those who struggle to center the importance of confronting climate change within their organizing. Question. In much of your writing, you talk about the relationship between mass migration and climate change. How can climate change be more concisely linked to existing opposition to borders and everyday struggle against the border regime? Out of the Woods replies. One place to start would be the estimate of 200 million climate migrants by 2050, which Norman Mayers devised over a decade ago. This is seen as a conservative projection, yet even this would mean that by 2050, one in every 45 people in the world would have been displaced by climate change. A report for the International Organization for Migration notes, quote, that on current trends, the capacity of large parts of the world to provide food, water, and shelter for human populations will be compromised by climate change, close quote. The framing of this capacity as a series of absolute natural limits is, of course, problematic. Carrying capacity is a product of racial, heteropatriarchal capital. That's the phrase that I will struggle and fail to call to mind in the conversation with Rob. Racial, heteropatriarchal capital. So backing up, the framing of this capacity as a series of absolute natural limits is, of course, problematic. Carrying capacity is a product of racial, heteropatriarchal capital as it works through nature, and of nature as it works through racial, heteropatriarchal capital. However, climate change will certainly further erode people's capacity to reproduce themselves, and in a manner that forces movement. The majority of these climate migrants will be racialized people. And it seems highly unlikely that those states least affected by climate change and/or most able to adapt to it, the white powers of Europe and America, will approach these climate migrants any differently than those racialized people already being murdered by their borders or imprisoned by their camps. Climate change is another reason to have to move, but it is not a reason for states to treat moving racialized people any differently. Okay, so we get some leftist sort of critical theory sounding lingo in there, which to me is off-putting. Maybe to you it endears you to these writers, but I'll post a link to this item in the show notes for this episode. But again, you can find it on basepublication.org. I imagine if you do a search for Out of the Woods, all one word, or as four words, you'll probably find this article, which is dated June 23rd, 2017. Now, in spite of some of the off-putting language, the people being interviewed here actually made some points that I kind of agree with. For example, the idea of ecological limits as being these hard, inflexible, objective barriers, I think is flawed. Without the high-yielding crop plants that were developed by Norman Borlaug and others, and the methodologies that we consider to be the Green Revolution, this planet could not support the number of people that it supports now, even temporarily in a state of overshoot. The ecological limit to the number of people that this environment could support changed when the technology changed. I have no doubt that human civilization is definitely living in overshoot, but I don't believe that the line that divides sustainable living from overshoot is clear or immutable. I think it can be moved. So, with that introduction, here's my most recent conversation with my friend Rob. All right, well, we are here in the fireplace room with Rob, and after much technical difficulty, we are getting underway. So, last time the Sea Realm Vault listeners heard my voice, I was talking with somebody about the most recent blog post by John Michael Greer about the next, I think, what do you say, twilight of environmentalism?
Right.
And so the person I was talking with, you know, he and I have a long shared history with John Michael Greer, so we had a very different conversation than I would have with somebody who is intelligent, literate, perceptive, but not really versed in these issues. That's you.
That's me.
So, what did you get from the John Michael Greer piece?
All right. Well, first, I have to make a disclaimer. I've never really thought about this subject before, even though I've seen it, you know, in the media mentioned, but I've never read about it in depth. So,
The subject you're talking about?
Well, ecofascism in general. So I never really tried to define it in my mind, you know. I just thought, okay, well, it's some extremist fringe element of something. And so I read the blog post that you just mentioned, and then I dug a little deeper to try to get me some definitions and more information in the background. So I've absorbed a lot of information in the last 24 hours, so it might not come out in a logical, coherent manner.
That's okay.
Okay. Anyway, so my...
Well, by the way, I should mention that we are drinking some homemade ginger beer that you brought.
Yes. You like it?
Yeah, I do.
All right. Well.
So, from your perspective, how would you summarize the general thrust of the initial essay?
Okay. Well,
next twilight. Of
next twilight of environmentalism. It looks like to me he's predicting that environmentalism will once again go dormant, as it did in the 80s, for instance. And he's saying the reason for that is that it will be defunded. Now, in the 80s, it was defunded by the government itself, by the ascendancy of the right, conservative movement, evangelical Christians, and their focus certainly shifted away from environmental policy, and things were rolled back in the 80s. And the reason for that was defunding. He thinks the reasons for defunding this time are going to be a little different than they were the last time. This time, we have this alt-right, all-eco-fascist fringe element that's attached itself to the more mainstream environmental movement. And so the mainstream environmental movement has, I don't know, foot soldiers, like maybe me. You know, I'm trying to change my life a little bit to do my part, right? But I don't, I'm not funding a think tank, or I'm not making charitable donations of any significance to the environmental movement. There's another part of the environmental movement that is like the wealthier folks, and they're into the like a class-based environmental theology or ideology.
I think theology is a fair,
yeah,
fair
whether they way to whether it. They understand that or not. But mm-hmm. those are the folks who are funding this movement. Now, the mainstream media is now covering this eco-fascist fringe element within the mainstream environmental movement, and these folks on the class side of it are not going to want to be associated with that. So they're going to start fleeing this mainstream, more mainstream movement and defunding it. And that will make it dormant again, which is really unfortunate because we're at this juncture in humanity right now where, you know, we're facing some very catastrophic weather issues, certainly, that we hadn't faced 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But it's an interesting article because I've never really thought about this stuff too much. I like his real life example of the class based environmentalists. He talks about an environmental conference on the island of Sicily, where 300 attendees, all of them from the economic and cultural elite, show up in their 119 private jets, and they have a fleet of Maseratis waiting for them so they could be chauffeured around anywhere they want to go at any time of the day or night, mm-hmm. Lavish parties probably and banquets, and using all kinds of resources and creating a huge carbon footprint just for this meeting.
And the ones who flew in on their private jets were really the ones who were minimizing their carbon footprint compared to their brethren, their sistren, who came in on their giant private yachts.
Yes.
Get notoriously poor fuel economy.
Yes, yes. But I never thought about the whole eco-fascist fringe element too much. It's very interesting.
Well, there's no reason why you should, really. Mm-hmm. You know, if you watch the news and you read mainstream opinions on social media, it seems like the primary obstacle that this country faces is this massive population of crypto neo-Nazis and white nationalists, and like the KKK has infiltrated, the highest offices of the land and controls corporate boards and things like that, which, as far as I can tell, the KKK is a bunch of losers with, more teeth or more brains than teeth or more teeth than brains. I don't know, not many of either.
Right.
Really at the very, very, very low end of the economic spectrum, with a few sort of weirdo, like public figures in the Silicon Valley crowd, like Mencius Moldbug. But for the most part, as John Michael Greer describes the eco-fascists, he says in terms of their numbers, there are probably fewer of them than there are flat earthers.
Right.
But more than there are people who literally believe that Elvis was the second coming of Christ. Somewhere between those two groups, you've got your eco-fascists, who are people who think that, we have to institute a totalitarian government in order to, institute sane environmental policies and save the world. But the whole world can't be saved, so we're going to start by saving the white people first.
Yes, yes, there is definitely. The more research I did into this whole idea, the more racism came out of my investigation over the past 24 hours. So it's not a very in-depth analysis or investigation.
Better than Colin, who did 15 minutes worth of research before shooting his criticism of Andrew Yang video.
Oh, okay.
Did you see that?
No, I know I did not. I know. where else do I go here? That was my summary.
Okay. So you started with this article because I'd recommended it, but then you went off, you branched out on your own. What else did you read?
Well, I thought, what is eco-fascism? Mm-hmm. I understand the eco part.
Right.
But maybe I don't understand how the definition of fascism has been wound up into this thing, right? So I said, okay, what's the definition of fascism? My working definition, I'll back up a little bit. I have a pretty good foundation of German history, having lived there and gone to university there. Mm-hmm. But I never really looked into the philosophical roots of fascism and National Socialism. So I thought, okay, let me find a definition, or at least a bunch of features or behaviors or thought patterns around the definition. So I found an article by or about Umberto Eco, the great Italian author. Mm-hmm. This is from, I think, the year he died, which was 3 years ago.
Author of, among other things, probably the thing most people have read or seen the movie, The Name of the Rose.
Yep. Or what's the other one? Foucault's Pendulum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very famous. I tried to read through that. I couldn't get through more than...
I never made any attempt. I've opened it on occasion and just read, you know, a few paragraphs and chuckled and closed the book.
The prose is just so... You know, one sentence is a paragraph, you know? Yeah. Well, anyway, so Umberto Eco says, okay, and I'm just going to go real fast through this because it's not that amazing. But he says, a cult of tradition... One has to look at the syllabus of every fascist movement to find the major traditionalist thinkers. so it's about tradition, rejection of modernism, a cult of action for action's sake. Disagreement is treason. You cannot disagree with whatever they're calling themselves at the moment. Fear of difference. This is probably part of the roots of the racism in fascism. Appeal to social frustration, which that's a huge factor right there in the appearance of German fascism / National Socialism. They had just been decimated in World War I, and they were being made to pay reparations beyond their ability to pay. Countries in shambles. It was very easy to appeal to that. As we are seeing,
the value of their currency was being degraded by outside forces.
Oh.
Causing the paradigm case of hyperinflation that everybody refers to.
I used to have a 1 million Deutschmark note from that time, from Weimar. Let's see. Obsession with a plot. Mm-hmm. There's always someone plotting to get us.
We do love our conspiracy theories.
Yes. So the last two points can be easily seen in our own society at the moment. The enemy is both strong and weak. Pacifism is trafficking with the enemy. If you're not taking action, violent action of some kind against your perceived enemies, the others, then you are weak or you're committing treason, right?
So who is it that said for evil to triumph, it only requires that men of good conscience do nothing?
Oh.
Something to that effect.
Yeah, I don't remember. Let's see. Everybody is educated to become a hero. Heroism is the norm. Cult of death. Machismo and weaponry. Again, we see this in our society, certainly. Let's see. Selective populism. Not sure exactly what that means, but a select group of citizens can be presented and accepted as the voice of the people. Fox News?
Yeah.
Or fascism speaks, news speak. All the Nazi or fascist schoolbooks made use of an impoverished vocabulary and an elementary syntax in order to limit the instruments for complex and critical reasoning. Again, once again, very prevalent in our society at the moment. So I thought that's interesting stuff, given my experience in Germany. And we're certainly seeing these things again in Germany over the past 30 years since the fall of communism and the mass migration to Germany and other parts of Europe due to war and climate change. So I thought, okay, where's this whole thing coming from? So I found an article. It's by Peter Staudenmayer. I've never heard of Peter Staudenmayer. It's called Fascist Ecology, the Green Wing of the Nazi Party and its Historical Antecedents. Very interesting. I should have sent it to you first, but I was just getting through it myself.
I would not have had time to read it.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Having lived in Germany, I knew that there was a very huge ecological consciousness amongst the population. Mm-hmm. When I lived there in the 80s, they were decades ahead of where we are now in the United States.
In terms of what?
Well, recycling, for instance, provision of mass transit to even the smallest villages. what else? In late 80s, they made every German auto manufacturer set up recycling centers where they had to be able to recycle 95% of the mass of a vehicle that they had produced.
So they don't have these auto graveyards all over the country like we do.
No.
Just stacks and stacks of old rusting car corpses.
And your BMW dies, it gets sent to BMW, and they crush it up and recycle the materials or whatever, right? So they were very conscious of this kind of thing. They had wind farms. They said a long time ago, we're getting rid of nuclear. Now, I don't know. You know, we can argue that one back and forth. Solar was certainly, they had the largest solar installation base per capita in the world. And that began when I was living there. Now, we're just starting to do some of those things and not so well, maybe, but some things pretty well. So anyway, ecology or environmentalism was basically founded in Germany. And I didn't know this. You know, the word for ecology is a German word, Ökologie, and it was coined in 1867. But a groundbreaking book was written in 1815 by a German author called On the Care and Conservation of Forests. When we see nature in the necessary connectedness and interrelationship, then all things are equally important. Shrub, worm, plant, human, stone, nothing first or last, but all one single unity. This is 200 years ago. That's pretty profound stuff. So at some point, a hippie movement, back to the land movement, began around 1900 in Germany and lasted for up until the 30s, apparently, at which point these hippies became co-opted by the Nazi Party. That's really interesting, because can you imagine like the back to landers that were coming around here in the early 70s now being hardcore evangelical Christian Republicans?
No, but I can certainly see them supporting Hillary Clinton, which is, you know, halfway there.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I've seen the definitive case study of hippies turning into, you know, the old people with the money who make the rules and who get very conservative in their old age.
Right. Well, what's the old saying? We all turn into our parents at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. I'll back off that one a little bit. But I think the key to the co-opting of the hippies into the Nazi Party as a fringe element, once again, was that there's a historical racism in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Germany has always been, up until 30 years ago, an incredibly homogeneous society. Very, very white, Nordic. They have their identity, complete package of a cultural identity, right? And it was very strong, very, very strong. So when the time of Weimar came along, everyone's frustrated, and so they start blaming other people. But certainly the French to blame, mm-hmm. and then they start blaming Jewish people. Well, these hippies already had this strain of racism in them because it was part of their society in general. So they were attracted to the Nazi Party. So it's kind of interesting. So in the United States, we have this fringe racist element being attracted to the mainstream environmental kind of movement. And in Germany, we have the hippies being attracted to this extremist ideology that is racist-based in many cases. I thought that was quite interesting. So we can see the historical parallels between what's happening now with our mainstream environmental movement and what happened 100 years ago in Germany. I thought that was very interesting. Where else do I go with this? Let's see. I had some other things. Right, this youth movement in the Weimar area were called the Wandering Free Spirits, Wandervögel. Yeah. The shift from nature worship to Führer worship is worth examining, the author says. And it is. I found this very interesting. And I'm going to do some more research into this kind of thing. Where else should we go on this?
Do you know who Paul Kingsnorth is?
I don't think so.
So there is I guess you could call it an environmentalist movement in, it's global now, but I think it started in Britain, called the Dark Mountain Movement, or maybe not movement, party? No, it's not a party. Anyway, Dark Mountain is the name of the project, that's it, the Dark Mountain Project. And one of the leading figures in it is a guy named Paul Kingsnorth, who is an environmentalist, who is an old-school environmentalist and objects to the fact that the mainstream environmental organizations now have on their boards, you know, representatives of big money, big industry, the, you know, like the Sierra Club, you know, organizations at that strata. They are lavishly funded by corporate dollars, and as a result, you know, their brand of environmentalism is very industrial. It's like, we need to build more mega-scale, you know, alternative power projects, huge wind farms, huge solar farms. And Paul Kingsnorth says, that's not environmentalism, that's industrialism. You know, so he's definitely a figure who says we should do less rather than try to extend ecological limits. But then I guess it was in 2017, he published a piece in The Guardian in which he explained why he voted for Brexit. And so in the John Michael Greer piece that I initially sent you, he mentions that there are fringe elements on the left right now who are saying that any talk of environmental limits is racist. And that seems kind of nutty. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I asked for some examples, and some of the other people commenting in the comment section sent me to a particular blog. So let me call that up. We have no internet access. I cannot pursue that right now.
Welcome.
Yeah. No, but I don't have a printer at home, so I don't have the option that you do there of bringing in printed pieces. But yeah, I started reading through this interview with some people who were talking about, and they had this long sort of ridiculous phrase, and they're using all of the, you know, the critical theory lingo.
Right.
And so it was like racialized, heteronormative patriarchy or something.
Right, right.
Yeah, so any talk of ecological limits comes from this mindset of, you know, wanting to support just straight white men and their power structure and, you know, to lock the poor people in place,
particularly
the brown people, so they can't move. They can't, you know, do anything to better their situation, and they certainly can't come live with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I state it like that, it's not entirely nuts. There is an element of truth to it. But, you know, you can start with a true proposition and then push it to absurdity, mm-hmm. which I think is what's happening, you know, in the fringe left on this topic. And John Michael Greer's prediction is that this position, which right now is very, you know, on the lunatic fringe, is going to move into the mainstream of, you know, corporate news punditry.
Right.
And yeah, that's a very concrete prediction he's made. You know, you can look back in 2 or 3 years and see if it came to pass or not.
Right.
So,
well, I read that article that you're referring to, mm-hmm. and there was a few points in there that made me think there's definitely some ecological racism, right? Like you say, keep all of the resources for all the white people, straight white men, mm-hmm. primarily.
Or the Chinese Han straight men.
Yeah, whichever culture wants to exclude someone else, that's mm-hmm. you're going to find that. So that certainly exists. But then there's also this like ecological nationalism where there's some rational thought going on where you don't want 20 million immigrants coming into your country and utilizing resources at a much higher rate than they did in their own country, right? If they were living somewhere where they didn't have electricity, didn't have running water, didn't have a car, didn't have a cell phone, didn't have all these things, right? They were using a fraction of what even you and I use, and we don't use a lot compared to a lot of Americans,
right?
Right? So it makes a little sense, economic nationalism, right? I want to preserve my country because I know we have a finite supply of resources. So I want to keep people out. And that can be a rational thing. But then you move into the racist part where they're not thinking about it rationally so much. They just don't want brown people around or black people around, right, to ostensibly to use the resources. But in reality, they just don't want them around. So yeah, it was interesting to think about the two sides of the coin like that. But it reminded me of some sci-fi movies where, you know, you had to be chosen to be the get on the last ship to space or the last ship to Mars as the Earth self-destructed or the atmosphere became unlivable.
There was 2012. Did you see that?
Yeah. No, I didn't, actually. I refused to because of the premise. Yeah.
Well, if there's a reason to refuse to see it, it's because it was directed by, what's his name, Roland Emmerich, who directed Independence Day and the Godzilla film from the 90s, which was terrible.
Okay.
The Patriot. He does just really, you know, big spectacle movies that are spectacularly dumb. And the premise to 2012 was just right along those lines. He also did The Day After Tomorrow, which was a surprisingly entertaining film, although scientifically, you know, absurd. Mm-hmm. Like, an ice age comes on over the course of an afternoon.
Yeah.
It's the premise. It's getting cold so fast. There's a group of characters who are in a big public library in New York City, and they're running down a hallway as the hall behind them freezes, you know, in real time. And they get to this room with a fireplace, and they slam the door just in time as this wave of cold hits the door.
Excuse me.
This is maybe not, intuitively obvious, but My big interest right now is the presidential campaign of Andrew Yang. And Andrew Yang is proposing to pay every American citizen over the age of 18 $1,000 a month. He calls it the freedom dividend. But he says, if we're going to pay every citizen $1,000 a month, that's going to be a strong incentive for other people to come here. We do have to control the borders. And right now, to say we need to have borders at all, much less, you know, control them and make decisions about who gets to come through and who doesn't, you know, the charge of racism is just a millisecond behind your admission that you know, you think there should be borders. And Andrew Yang is an Asian guy. You know, he's the son of Taiwanese immigrants. So he believes in immigration, but he also believes in controlling the borders. So he's got a little bit of insulation against the charge of racism.
Right.
But just a little bit, because people are already saying that East Asians are entirely capable and culpable with white supremacy. You know, they can be white supremacists underneath their yellow skin.
Okay.
Yeah. Which right now, I think, to me anyway, has the ring of, you know, lunacy to it. But I could see, you know, if he really starts doing well in the polls and really starts doing well in the primaries, that that sort of reasoning could make its way to the Washington Post, you know, which in 2016, as Caitlin Johnstone says, ran 16 different anti-Bernie Sanders hit pieces over the course of 16 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. Just hardcore, you know, Bernie's a crazy socialist, Hillary's the only option, you know. And Jeff Bezos owns the Post. And Jeff Bezos has his rocket company, and he has deep ties with the Pentagon. And, you know, according to this Australian journalist I'm quoting, Caitlin Johnstone, he's a CIA asset of some sort. I don't know how much truth there is in that. But if you're building rockets, you're certainly sitting down and having lunch with the Pentagon from time to time.
Sure.
There's no way to avoid it.
Especially if you're looking for Pentagon contracts and NASA contracts too, part of the federal government. Sure.
And Jeff Bezos actually has made public statements to the effect of, you know, look, if I can't do business with the Pentagon, what's this world coming to? You know, he's not hiding at all. I mean, yes, of course I have business with the intelligence organizations, and of course I have business with the Pentagon. I mean, I'm the richest man in the world, you know, and I build rockets, so of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, that's an interesting thing you say about the universal basic income attracting more immigrants. I never thought about it so much. I was more thinking about it from internal economics. But, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So then we need to also control the northern border. Why aren't we doing that already? Because there's this perception that only the white people are coming across the northern border, and it's the brown people coming across the southern border.
There's a, I don't know what the percentages are, but you know, some people who cross the southern border are headed for Canada.
Sure. You know? And more folks are going to Canada to come to the States or vice versa, like you say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think I read that there are 6 times more people coming across the Canadian border than the southern border.
But are they coming to stay?
Well, a lot of people are coming across. They have like visas already, and then they overstay the visa, and they never leave, right? That's actually the majority of immigration to the United States, illegal immigration. And more than half of them are coming on aircraft with legal visas, and they just overstay them. And, yeah. But I think it's funny that we're not controlling that border. Well, we are, but not like the southern border. Nobody's saying, build a wall across Canada border, right? No one's saying that. I haven't heard anybody say it, at least.
Although you do now have to have a passport to move back and forth across that border, whereas when I was a kid, you didn't.
No, when I was a kid, it was literally a painted stripe on the road. Okay, and it said Canada on one side and USA on the other side. I mean, we have a town called the Derby Line. Mm-hmm. And the Derby Line was that painted strip. And people lived and worked on both sides. And there was no border checkpoint. They were. But now, probably, like you're right, there's probably a border station there. You probably got to show every piece of documentation.
The last time I crossed that border, I got detained for hours.
Seriously?
While I was traveling with a British guy who didn't have a printed itinerary for his intended movements in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah. No, they were real jackboot jerks about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's different. In 1989, a German friend and I came back to visit from Germany when I was living in Germany, and I wanted to show him Vermont. Mm-hmm. So we got in my mom's car. We drove to Canada because he had never been to Canada. And I said, okay, let's spend 30 minutes in Canada. So they had actually a little checkpoint. It was like a telephone booth with a border guy in it, kind of probably sleeping when we got there. Mm-hmm. So we stopped. He's like, okay, what's going on? Where are you going? Where are you from? And I said, well, I'm from Vermont. I live in Germany. My friend's from Germany. We just want to go across the border to the next village and buy some postcards for my friend to send back from the post office there. He's like, what? And he says, all right, go ahead. He never checked our IDs or anything. And 30 minutes later, we came back and waved at him, and he's like, all right, whatever.
Well, getting into Canada is the easy part. Getting back into the U.S. these days, that's where you're likely to run into trouble. But yeah, no, there's definitely security at the northern border. Uh-huh. It's not a come as you go, come as you will sort of thing.
Right, but where do we go as a country with the predicted massive climate change migration? Which was the it was 200 million people by 2050 or something. It was in one of these articles.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we already have, I think I read, it's like 28 or 38 million people on the move around the globe. And they're not all fleeing from war, but a lot of them, they're fleeing from, they can't farm anymore, or they're flooded out of their homelands, or, you know, forest fires have destroyed their homelands and their ability to stay there. And that's not going to get any better. And these countries where these people are primarily coming from don't have the collective assets and or organization to deal with these kinds of issues on a large scale. We barely have the ability to do so in this country. Look at what's happening in the Midwest right now. I think I read in July that only 58% of farms had actually planted in July. That means they don't plant.
Right.
You can't plant in July and then have your crop die of frostbite. You know, so we're barely able to deal with this. And the floods and the hurricanes and that kind of thing, we're barely able to handle that. And we have a lot of wealth, and we're much more organized than a lot of other countries, for good or worse. I don't know. You can critique it, whatever. But it's much better than Haiti, for instance. Yeah. The Sicily example reminded me of Haiti.
Yeah.
And the humanitarian aid and all of the NGOs, and especially the Red Cross, the huge scandal, were given hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for the last, I don't even know what the last disaster was, whether it was the hurricane or the earthquake or something happens there every few years, right?
Right.
Well, anyway, so the story of the Red Cross is they collected, I don't know, I'm going to say 300 million. It's in that magnitude, I don't know. And they were supposed to build so many houses with this money, like thousands and thousands of houses. Well, they built like 14 houses. Yeah. And I'm probably wrong about the number, but again, it's in that magnitude.
Right.
But at the same time, all these Red Cross folks, people are renting all of the most expensive condos and apartments in the main city, which I forget the name
Port
of.
Port-au-Prince.
Yeah, Port-au-Prince, yeah. They're driving Range Rovers around, and all these people are like dying in the streets, and they're just kind of driving around them, you know, and not doing what they did. But they collected that money and lived like kings and queens for a couple of years. And
that's just one specific example of a very familiar story that gets played out year after year after year.
Yep. So that reminded me of you emailed me an article called Out of the Woods, or no, it's by Out of the Woods Collective, right? And they talked about...
Do you have it printed out?
No, I didn't.
Because the phrase I was looking for is in that article.
Yeah, necropolitics.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're basically freezing out climate change migrants and trapping them in their hell that they're trying to escape, right?
Yep. Now, you can't really, you know, claim climate change with the Haiti example, because Haiti is just half of an island.
Sure.
And
sure.
On the other half of the island, you have what was for a long time a green right-wing dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And Trujillo, I think, was the dictator, and he loved trees. And he said, you're not cutting down the trees, goddammit. So if you look at a satellite image of Hispaniola, the Haiti side is denuded. The Dominican Republic side is green.
Sure.
And, you know, it's the same island. The same hurricanes, the same earthquakes that hit Haiti hit the Dominican Republic, but the Dominican Republic still has a fairly intact ecosystem to provide, you know, ecosystem services, and it's just not nearly as precarious. Now, also, I have to mention, you know, in all fairness, there has been a centuries-long international embargo against Haiti.
Sure.
Because Haiti owes France for the value of the slaves who revolted and killed the slave masters.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. That's just unbelievable.
Unfortunately, it's entirely too believable.
Yeah. I feel badly for that country because they've been targeted by so many other countries, especially the United States. The United States has had a subconscious hatred of Haiti. It was conscious at some point directly after the revolt,
right,
and the kicking out of the French. Now it's a subconscious thing. And I don't think anybody in our government who is taking advantage of Haiti and wrecking Haiti even understands why they're doing it anymore. Maybe some of them do. I don't know. But.
Right. It's an institutional endeavor that has, you know, decades-long momentum. And you don't have to understand the history to plug into it and play your part.
Sure.
Yeah. So what else from the John Michael Greer piece? I'm going to be talking to him in a pretty high production value video in a video production studio down in Lancaster in a couple weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then the group that is paying for that is going to pay to promote the video, mm-hmm. which is going to be on my channel. So I'm,
very cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that.
Good for you. Good for you.
But is there any topic that you think should be brought up in that discussion? Mm.
Let's see. I think I mentioned pretty much what I had found important. Yeah. I don't know. I really was interested in this whole German kind of connection. Yeah.
You know, I just came back from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and while I was down there, I commented to the person I was staying with that, you know, compared to Bellows Falls, Lancaster, one, you know, it's got 50,000 people, so it's going to be more dynamic. But there are places, you know, with 50,000 people that are no place you'd want to be, but in Lancaster, everything is neat and clean and maintained and landscaped, and everything is just thriving and prosperous mm-hmm. and bustling, and, you know, there's a couple of nice universities there. But it just the difference between here and there, it seemed like it required more explanation than just a bit more money and a couple of universities. And my friend's explanation was, well, we have a lot of Germans here.
That's it.
A lot of people here of German heritage. The Germans, they take care of stuff.
They go places and they build stuff.
You know?
They build societies.
They
build
maintain it.
Infrastructure, right? My greatest example of that is that I lived in Central America for 10 years. As you know, I lived in Nicaragua, mm-hmm. which is just to the north of Costa Rica. Well, at the end of... So I say this thing. It's kind of funny. Look at Costa Rica. Look at Nicaragua. Okay. Costa Rica has a thriving economy, has good infrastructure, a decent school system, healthcare. I think they have socialized healthcare, universal healthcare. And things are moving forward, right? Mm-hmm. Roads are nice, everything. Nicaragua... When I arrived there, you know, infrastructure was terrible. You couldn't even drive down the main highway more than 20 miles an hour. Power cuts every week, sometimes every day for a week. Water would go out. Basic health care, but not more than that. And it was just – it was messed up. Corrupt government. Well, I tell everyone – what happened with the foreign migration or foreign influence in those two countries? Costa Rica, at the end of World War II, received lots of Germans. Oh. Lots of ex-Nazis, of course, Project mm-hmm. Odessa, but also other migrants who wanted to escape the destruction of their country and go somewhere else. Okay, they went and they built stuff. What did Nicaragua get? The U.S. Marines.
Enforcing the will of the United States Fruit Company?
Yeah. Turned it into a giant plantation. What is interesting, though, is in the We good time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I need to go in about 5 minutes.
Okay. In the 1880s, the Nicaraguan government invited German families to settle in Nicaragua. In the 1880s. And 188 families emigrated to Nicaragua. And they went to the north, where there's mountains and it's cooler, big forests and stuff. A little bit more like Germany than the rainforest of the south. Well, they built the first railroad. they built infrastructure, which you can still see today, the old stone buildings and things, opposed to the little shacks and little concrete shacks. And they did some very positive things, and there's still German-derived people there now. I've met them. I went to a plantation, a beautiful plantation, well-organized, self-sustainable. Just unbelievable, you know? So you're right. When they go somewhere, they build stuff. Look at South America, all the Germans who went there. And there are whole towns that are just beautiful, but they look like Bavaria, especially in Argentina, you know? Yeah, in Bolivia.
The places where the Nazis are supposed to be hiding.
Yes. Yes.
So now, if you're in favor of street sweeping, you're a Nazi. That'll be the narrative going forward. If you don't like trash in the streets, you must be a Nazi.
Well, I enjoyed living in Germany because the streets were clean and everything was orderly. And people, when the don't walk sign came on, nobody walked. I used to ride my bicycle down at rush hour in central Berlin at rush hour with no fear because All the German drivers had to take a 12-week, multi hours per day for 12 weeks driver training course. So they obeyed the laws, but Germans were obeying laws anyway, but now they're trained in how to use a car. I had no fear, and I would do stupid stuff, go between cars and zigzag through downtown Berlin. And I'd go up to the front of the line at the stoplight, and I would race the cars to get across the intersection. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever hit me or anything, and I never had any fears. But when I moved to Arizona, I didn't even take my bicycle out of its box. For 10 years, almost 10 years, because I was so afraid of the drivers and the laziness and not being trained. And, oh, man.
You know, when I lived in New York City, sometimes I would take Olga places where she was going to, you know, give somebody a massage. And I would just sit in the truck parked, you know, out on the street. And if I'm in the truck behind the wheel, I can park in a no parking zone. The police will tell me to move before they write a ticket. I remember I'm sitting in the truck at an intersection, and it was a three-way stop, and cyclists who were on the far left, you know, because there was no other road coming in from the left, they would run a red light.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, they're running basically parallel to the parked cars that are parked along the left side, and there's no possibility that they're going to get hit if they run this light. But I'm just sitting there, and I'm watching this police officer give ticket after ticket after ticket after ticket to the cyclists. And I don't know anybody who rides a bike in New York City who hasn't wiped out, you know, and been injured or, you know, nearly injured by the negligence of somebody in a car.
Sure, sure.
And yet, you know, the New York solution is to crack down on the cyclists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a cyclist, we have a joke. The healthiest way to get hit by a car is to be a cyclist.
All right. Well, we should wrap it up. But,
okay.
Thank you very much, as always.
Yes, thank you.
All right, that brings us to the end of another installment of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. If you have feedback, send it my way. If there are viewpoints that you want me to consider, which I have not yet considered, at least not out loud, again, send them my way. KMO@SeaRealm.com, and of course you know that's a C, the letter C is in consciousness, and then a dash, and then R-E-A-L-M. SeaRealm.com. Most of the folks listening to this podcast have been listening for years. You know how to contact me. But I say it anyway, you know, because it amazes me how many people tell me that they couldn't find a contact link on my website, which I will admit, there isn't one. But given the hundreds of times you've heard me say that my email address is kmo@searealm.com, it just seems odd that that information hasn't stuck. But I guess when I start to say familiar phrases, it's easy to tune out. Hey, I want to tell the Sea Realm Vault subscribers, before anybody else, the week after next, I will be going back to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where John Michael Greer and I will be recording a video conversation on stage in a professional video production studio. It's going to be a high production value affair. It's going to get posted on my YouTube channel as well as the Sea Realm podcast. And then the Progressives for Immigration Reform and associated groups are going to fund a promotional campaign to spread it around. So I'm pretty excited about that. If you have any questions that you'd like me to put to John Michael Greer on stage, send them my way. All right, that is all. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.